She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And trust me when I say we are going to give you a lot to think about today with our guest. This show is sponsored by Chapman Tucson, true leaders in the selling and promotion of energy-efficient cars and good stewards of this community. We thank them for their support of the Mrs. Green's World mission and vision. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today to hear from yet another impressive, informative guest whose institute is doing great things for the planet on our behalf. While we are sleeping, they are going about the good work. My guest today is Alan Savory, and he is the president of the Savory Institute. The institute was created to promote large-scale restoration of the world's grasslands through holistic management. Welcome, Alan, and thanks for being my guest.
Thank you.
I really do have lots of questions, and I was writing up my notes earlier today and said we have lots of ground to cover, and then I put no pun intended. It just really came out of me. But I'd like to say I have two short announcements and say a little bit more about you, if you can bear with me. My two quick announcements are that there are exciting things happening in Mrs. Green's World. We have our membership program. It's alive and growing, and we would love for our listeners to become an official supporter of Mrs. Green's World. You can do so by visiting our website at mrsgreensworld.com and click on the Mrs. Green's World Sustainer in the upper right-hand corner on our homepage to become an official member of our growing community of people who care greatly about this planet. And another piece of good news for us is that we can say there's an app for that. We were challenged in our beginning years about people saying, well, how can I listen? Well, now you can listen on any smart device you have, your iPad, your iPhone, your Droid, your smartphone, you name it. It's called Igloo Radio. And again, visit our homepage, click download free mobile app, and you're there. It works for all mobile devices. And we are really getting great feedback about this from our listeners because they can put it on their iPad, put it on their phone, and listen while they're driving in the car. And of course, that's exciting for us because of the great guests we have. So, Alan, let me take a little bit of a breath here, and I think it's important to actually share with our guests that you created the philosophy and practice of holistic management. It's not just a phrase that you're doing. You were born in Rhodesia, Southern Africa. You pursued an early career as a research biologist and game ranger in the British colonial service of what was then Northern Rhodesia. And I was reading that and I'm thinking how things have changed. It's now Zambia. And later as a farmer, game rancher, politician, and international consultant based in Southern Rhodesia, today Zimbabwe. So you've seen a lot of changes.
I have, yes, indeed, and worn many hats, but always dealing with the same problem.
Always dealing with the same problem, which is rather daunting a little bit. But I want to ask you this. This is the only trick question, and I said that I wouldn't have any. But did you have an institute that was based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at any point?
I had an organization based here, but they've gone their own way. And then with other people, we formed the Savory Institute.
Okay.
To further the world more globally, to work globally.
Right. Because, here's the big shocker, my husband has a degree in range management, and when I told him who our guest was, he said, Alan Savory, who has an approach of holistic management for the land? I said, yes, and he was in college 30 years ago, so he was studying what you were doing way back then. So kudos to you.
Yeah, it's been going on for over 50 years for me.
And I did not know it. Okay, so let's start with what I would call the harsh reality of what's going in our world right now around agriculture. It is a harsh reality. It's a serious global situation, and Tell us what you see. Paint us a picture for what we should be concerned about right now.
Well, we should be more concerned about agriculture even than fossil fuels. Let me explain that. Everything depends upon agriculture. Without agriculture, you couldn't have your program. You can't have an orchestra, a choir, a school, a university, a government, an army, a city. Everything is based on agriculture. And throughout history, and it's happened many times, when the agriculture fails, if people as societies couldn't deal with the problems of declining agriculture and rising population, that complexity, the whole cities failed, and more than 20 civilizations have failed. Now we're facing the problem globally. Now, when I say agriculture, most people think of crop production. No, agriculture is not crop production. Agriculture is the production of food and fiber, hides, hair, you know, clothing, everything, from the world's land and waters. So fisheries, forestry, wildlife management, harvesting of wildlife in the past, it was all agriculture. And the crop part of it does produce a major part of our food, but only on about roughly 18 to 20% of the world's land surface. So by far the greater proportion of the planet is under non-cropland agriculture. And when we look at how it's doing, it's not doing well. We need about half a ton of food per year for a human. We've got about 7 billion people now, rising to 10 billion. And right now, if we look at the land aspects of agriculture alone, we're producing more than 10 tons of eroding soil for every human alive today, every year. So frankly, this is the most frightening statistic in the world, and very few people are talking about it. Agriculture is not only the most destructive industry we have, far more so than coal or oil or anything else. What's worse, agriculture is contributing enormously to climate change, and the climate is changing without question. And when we solve the fossil fuel problem, as we must and will do, then climate change will continue if we don't address the agricultural problem. Now, there's another aspect to it, is that we get what we call feedback loops happening in nature. One people have talked about is if the thawing tundra releases methane, that heats the atmosphere more and thus more thaws and releases methane. But there are other feedback loops going. One is mega fires. What they're calling mega fires.
Right.
Yeah, are increasing in severity, frequency, and where they never occurred in the past. And those feed climate change, and that feeds more mega fires. And then there's desertification occurring mostly in the 2/3 of the world's land surface that is not under cropland, where the rainfall is seasonal. And desertification feeds climate change, which feeds further desertification. And we can't address these up in the sky. We've got to address these on the land. So don't need to say more. Agriculture is our most pressing issue in the world today.
And one of the things that you so wisely point out in the research I've done and read about you is that there is an incredible ripple effect that you have touched on. But you have the, you know, desertification, the droughts, the floods. Then the trickle down to me, or the ripple effect, is the social breakdown, the health problems, mass immigration. I mean, I don't really understand why people aren't paying attention. I know that I am, because I have Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. But talk a little bit about the ripple effect, because to me, for our listeners, it's facing us. Does it have to hit us in the head like with a baseball bat, or what is it going to take to get people's attention? Because there's a vast number of consequences that are occurring because of the global desertification. That's a mouthful.
All right. Well, the what you're calling the ripple effects are desert. Let's just take it from the start. What is desertification?
Right.
And that I explained in a recent TED talk that's gone out to over 2.5 million people and still going. And finally, that 20 minutes of that broke through and why people are beginning to pay attention. Because what I'm saying now to you today and what I put there is a message of incredible hope. I'm not a doomsdayer.
Right.
All right, so desertification begins when we make the available rainfall less effective. Now, scientists and people in the public see this as the rain isn't what it used to be. The climate isn't what it used to be. No, it's exactly what it used to be. Very erratic. But we make, through our management and policies, we make the rainfall less effective. Now, I explained in that TED talk how that works. It's very simple, and any gardener would understand it. When anything you do leads to a very high percentage of the soil surface between the plants being bare, and then the majority of the rain that falls runs off, leading to floods, or it soaks into the soil but evaporates out of the soil surface, leading to droughts. And this is why drought and flood are increasing so badly and have been for 10,000 years, gradually increasing and now accelerating. Now, effective rainfall simply means a covered soil, so that whatever rain you're getting, low or high rainfall areas, the bulk of it flows into the soil instead of to floods, and then it only leaves the soil in two ways, flowing through the soil to perennial river steady flow, to wetlands, sponges, underground aquifers, underground water, or it leaves the soil upwards through green growing plants. And the worldwide, what is occurring, mainly in two-thirds of the world where the rainfall is very seasonal, the growth seasons are seasonal, not the tropical forests where it's warm, damp, humid every day of the year. You hardly need to think what clothing to take out every day because it's the same. Once you get into the areas of the world, which is most of it, where it's very seasonal, it can be very cold, it can be very hot, it can be dry, it can be wet. When you get into those, that's where the deterioration is at its worst, leading ultimately to desertification. That's why we use that fancy word. And fortunately for us, after some 60 years of studying this and trying to solve it, the problem, what I found was there are only two things that actually lead to a very high percentage of bare soil between the plants. So we've got two things to address. And those two things are too few large herbivores, cows, sheep, goats, buffalo, bison, elephants, whatever. Too few large herbivores wandering around on the land and or fire. And if we can address those two things, the rainfall becomes more effective and desertification starts reversing. Now, having explained what it is, the ripple effects or the symptoms are first the increasing floods and droughts in both severity and frequency, and then also mounting poverty, social breakdown, violence, blaming minorities, emigration, as you're seeing to Europe,
right,
with boatloads of people dying or across the Mexican border into the United States, this mass emigration to cities and the massive slums that are building around cities. It's not only that, it's dust into cities. And Beijing, China's biggest city, is some days now getting over 250,000 tons of sand dumped on the city in one day. And nature will win that one. All right, so these are some of the symptoms. And then also, unfortunately, providing an ideal environment for recruitment to Al-Qaeda and other dissident organizations, which the military has to try to deal with. But the number one, one of the major things, is the recruitment to these organizations. from the poverty and the violence, etc. And it's going to lead to wars over water, worse than wars over oil. So there are many symptoms we have to deal with. And at the end of those, it also leads to climate change.
And what I want to, you know, just kind of wax poetic about is the wars over water, which have, in my opinion, started. The lands are, you know, being purchased. We don't even know this is going around us. Talk about, I think they'll be more violent and more ferocious than those fought over oil, because we can't live without water. So that's another major component that frustrates me, because here in the desert Southwest, there are millions of people walking around Phoenix and Tucson that don't even get that piece yet, that water is a precious resource. It's a big frustration for me. And your explanation of how the water needs to be absorbed is critical. It has to have some place to go and not just run off.
And Arizona is a chronic case. As is New Mexico, where I live half a year. Just to illustrate for your listeners, Gina, if you make 1 inch of rain more effective, in other words, stay in the soil and leave through the soil or through plants, in New Mexico, just 1 inch, and that would make money and not cost money to do that, it equals every year for the next 1,000 years, 3 dams full of water the size of Elephant Butte, which is the biggest dam in this state, and when built was the biggest dam in the United States. So you can see the astronomical amounts of water we save or bring to human use if we just stop the desertification of, or begin to stop the desertification of Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and all the western states.
And what happens, which I've seen very up close and personally, is we had a cabin in Greer, and it was burned down in the Wallow Fire. And I know this may sound kind of, you know, stating the obvious, but what was so devastating, not just the land that was so scorched and will not be repaired in our lifetime because of the severity of the fire, once the rain started, I mean, Alan, Greer had its second big, huge, devastating mess to clean up, and houses were flooded, mudslides, roads closed, because, as you say, there was nowhere for the water to go. It was, you know, I called it double devastation to go up and look at our land and then see it being washed away because all the trees were gone. There was nothing there to keep it, you know, to keep the water in and to start reforestation. And so it's a very up close and personal experience for me. Let's talk a little bit about why is there such public ignorance? And I don't say that in any, you know, condescending manner about cities will be fine. I've heard guests say that on my show. I've read it. Big cities will be fine once this, you know, apocalyptic condition happens, and poor rural communities will suffer the most. Not true.
No, the cities are going to suffer the most, that I can assure you. And that's why I'm, in my talks I give around many countries, I'm trying to concentrate on the young people and in the cities, because they're going to suffer unbelievably. When cities run out of food and water, the violence will be incredible. Rural people still know how to look after themselves, and I'm not worried about the rural poor when, you know, the muck hits the fan finally. It'll be the cities that we need to wake up. But when you say why the ignorance, let me deal with that a little bit, because it's very widespread and has gone on for a long time. When Alfred Nobel came up with his wonderful idea of Nobel Prizes, to attract the best young minds and best minds into the areas that mattered most for humanity, I'm sure he was advised by some of the best minds of the time, and they determined that physics, chemistry, they argued about mathematics, etc., and they determined what constituted such important issues that they warranted a Nobel Prize. You'll notice there's no prize for environment or agriculture. So this disconnect goes back far and deep.
And Alan, we're going to have to take a short break. I cannot believe it that I got the sign that we are about 30 seconds from taking a break. So can you hold that thought? We'll come back to it, and I'd love to hear more about that. Everybody, please stay here with us. I'm sure you're hanging on every word as I am. Alan Savory, the president of the Savory Institute. Please stay here with us. Hear more about grasslands through holistic management.
Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if you have just joined us, you're going to want to go back and listen to the beginning of the show when the podcast is up, because I don't think anybody's going to want to miss a word of this. And I say that sincerely. Our guest is Alan Savory. He's the president of the Savory Institute, which was created to promote large-scale restoration of the world's grasslands through holistic management. Alan, thank you for being here with us. And before we go back to, it's shocking to me what you pointed out about the categories for the Nobel Prize. I'm encouraging everybody, we will tweet about it, we will put it up on Facebook. I encourage everybody to listen to Alan's TED Talk. You don't just get 2.5 million views on a TED Talk. Trust me, I'm going to do a TED Tucson talk in December. And you know, if you start out with 100, you're lucky. So 2.5 million, kudos to you, Alan Savory, for having that many listeners. And hopefully it's reflective of a growing interest in the severity of these issues. So let's talk about the history of overlooking this grave and serious issue with something as world-renowned as the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, that's what got us to discussing the widespread ignorance of the seriousness,
right,
etc. I do want to stress, and I hope we can get to it, the solutions. There's no one solution, but the way to solving this is relatively simple, and we'll move there. But we need to deal with the disconnect. Now, part of it is nobody's to blame for this, but our whole educational system has gone into siloed experts in narrow disciplines,
right, yes,
etc., and an inability to see the whole or pull it together. When I began working on this problem as a very motivated young scientist, we didn't have today's buzzwords, biodiversity loss, desertification, climate change. All I was seeing was massive environmental degradation. But if you take those three fields, biodiversity loss, there are people working on that, organizations, universities, you name it, environmental groups, and they have their own conferences, papers, publications, etc. Then you've got people doing the same in desertification and the same with climate change, different conferences, etc. These are one problem. Without biodiversity loss, desertification simply doesn't occur. It's only a symptom of biodiversity loss. Unless you address desertification, we cannot address climate change. So they're one issue. But to get anywhere that they talked of as one issue, one conference, anything like that in the world today would simply be impossible because of our educational system and the structuring of our environmental, all our organizations. So this, again, is the situation we've arrived in. Nobody to blame for it, but we need to face it now and begin pulling together. When we look at the desertification aspect of this that I was trying desperately to solve after making some massive blunders, some of which I mentioned in the TED Talk, when I was looking at that, I finally came to the understanding that we can never solve that with any technology even imaginable. Fire is part of the problem, and resting land is part of the problem. And I showed that in the TED Talk, showing a national park or wilderness area in this state totally rested and desertifying worse than or as bad as anything in Africa. So how do you address that? And the answer is there is only one tool that we have to introduce to our toolbox, because humans are tool-using animals, and all our creativity, all the money in the world, and all the labor in the world cannot even drink a cup of water without using technology. If I say to you, drink some water, you have to go to the nearest river and put your mouth down or drink it with your hands.
Right.
We are tool-using animal, and we have no option, and no scientist puts their neck out that far unless they're 10,000% certain. We have no option but to reconsider how we're using livestock, because livestock properly managed are the only tool that can reverse desertification now practically on the scale needed. Now, that's the subject of the TED Talk. Now, in working out how to do that in the early days, I was getting some very good results, amazing results, but I was also getting failures. And in science, unless we can get consistent results, even though I wasn't dealing with research, I was now dealing with management, I treated it the same way. We had to be able to get consistent results. And only in 1984, finally, did we begin to get consistent results. And that was when the word holistic came into the holistic planned grazing. And that, when we discovered that, I realized, oh my goodness, I've hit the tip of a much bigger iceberg here. I've accidentally, not by design, discovered a very simple way in which we can begin to address the full social, cultural, environmental, and economic complexity in all policies of big environmental organizations, government agencies, international agencies, and because we've got to, in the end, address this complexity. And right now, today, in management and policies, we don't. We have a very simple context of addressing a problem generally, or need, desire, making a profit, etc. And these contexts are okay if you're building a building or making something. They're not okay if you're managing agriculture and the complexity of nature. So it's a very hopeful situation now, but the solution will be having to use livestock properly run and change our attitude to livestock, and then policies being developed holistically when the public understanding can reach that level.
Well, can you just explain to us in layman's terms what you mean about managing livestock properly? I think that's a really big question.
Well, it is, and what it involves is we'd had thousands of years of people bunching livestock and moving them, but it caused the great man-made deserts. Those were the pastoralists whose whole culture is livestock. Then we'd had 100 years of modern range science, the stuff your husband trained in, rotational and many, many grazing systems, but that accelerated desertification in the United States, Africa, and elsewhere, following the American lead on that. So faced with that dilemma in the 1960s, when I realized we had no option but to use livestock, I didn't know how to use them. And rather than reinvent the wheel, I began looking at every profession, because I was an independent scientist, not linked to any one
right.
profession. And I looked at businesses and everything else, and finally found that the military was the one to look at, because for over 300 years, they had had to deal with incredibly complicated situations in immediate battlefield conditions, and they had to train people quickly, etc. So I simply took 300 years of their experience, said, okay, I see how they're doing it, breaking it up into tiny little components, building on one another in a certain order till you come up with the best possible plan right now. Then I had another dilemma, was the military had always had to do this for short time periods.
Right.
Immediate battlefield conditions last for hours or days usually. But farmers, pastures, ranchers had to deal with year-long periods and more. And then I realized, all right, what I can do is to put this on a chart. And so what holistic planned grazing is, very simply, is first making the complex decision. Should livestock even be there? Because in situations like Brazil's forests, they shouldn't be there at all. So it's making those decisions first. Are livestock essential to supporting people and reversing desertification? And that comes out correct in most situations. And then once we know that, then introducing a planning process to deal with the complexity of the livestock, the wildlife, the crops, etc., on the land, as all farmers and many pastures and ranches have to do. And once we got that in place, it worked immediately, and it should have, because it had 300 years of experience behind it. So in handling livestock, if we're going to use them as we must, if we want to save civilization as we know it, then we have to use holistic planned grazing unless somebody can develop an even simpler method.
So when you say, I understand certainly why Brazil, not devastating rainforests, so to put cattle on it to graze and introducing that whole conversation, but what about places, I think one of the grasslands that you manage as part of the grassland component is in Hawaii. Do cattle belong in Hawaii? I mean, I went to Maui and we went up in the hills and it looked like desertification on steroids. What's happening over there? And is that a good habitat? Should there be cattle in places in Hawaii?
Well, anywhere, be it Hawaii or anywhere else, we do the same. We do the decision making holistically and look at it. And if desertification is occurring, we'd look at what tools are available. If desertification is occurring in grasslands, it's because the biological decay process has been replaced by chemical, physical breakdown, which is gradual. And you wouldn't say, well, the cattle were never in Hawaii. That's true, but that's not the point. All regions of the world, when humans arrived there with fire, spear, language, organization, they absolutely decimated the animals that were there.
Right.
And finally, that is being accepted, that these massive die-offs coinciding with the last ice age were not due to the weather. They were due to humans arriving with the skills I mentioned, particularly language, organization, and fire, because that wiped out most animals on most continents, most large herbivores. So we wouldn't bemoan the past. We'd say, what can we do today?
Right.
And that's why I said today, practical terms, we've only got livestock to help us. So we would bring the livestock in, and then they have to be managed properly.
And to help get back to a restorative state. So it is a holistic approach.
Absolutely. All management in the end will need to be holistic, and I don't think any scientist would argue that today. It's just that we don't know how to get that out quickly to the public and our organizations.
So as part of the Savory Institute, it's not just the concept and the big idea of what you're trying to get attention about, what our global situation is. You have grasslands, which is managing, I believe, over 200,000 acres all over the world.
Way more than that. Oh, something like 40 million acres.
And you know what? This is always gets me. I Googled this so many times, and that's on your website. So it's like, it's got to be updated. I thought that is not, even it doesn't fit with the rest of all of the content in your website. So that sounds a lot more hopeful to me. And it does say that on there, though, because I just did that research in the last couple of days, and I'm glad to correct that for when we do our social media about the show. Thank you for bringing that up. But when you go into manage a property, I was very impressed by you have a very partnership approach, looking at the whole piece, who's there, who your partners are. Do you want to talk a little bit about that process? Because it's such a positive, integrated approach to change.
Yes, certainly. We do it at the individual farm level or anything. The first thing is to decide what is the unit being managed. Let's put our arms around that. And that starts by looking at who makes the actual decisions, who has veto power over them, and who's implicated in any way essential to it but doesn't actually make the decisions. And it starts bringing in everybody, and we get that clear. Then we look at the land base and the sources of income. And once we've got that, the people involved in actually making decisions or having veto power over them, they then define the context for all future actions and objectives. And that's what's lacked throughout history of mankind. That's what is truly new in this, is that we now recognize that any objective without a context or with inadequate context, like me saying to you, I want to light a fire, you have no reason to believe that's wise or unwise till you ask me why and get the context. Mm-hmm. Now, in management today, literally, universally, the context is always too simplistic for the complexity involved. So the people involved in any situation define or determine that context, how they want their lives to be like, tied to their life-supporting environment through forms of production, then we have a context and management proceeds. And we do the same at a national level, with a national holistic context, anything. We have to have an adequate context for management. And it always involves uniting people, bringing people together. It's an amazing uniting influence. And ultimately, this is how we're going to have to do what I call uniting team humanity. Otherwise, we're not going to survive.
And there's such a sweet spot, I think, in the American consciousness anyway, of the grasslands. I mean, it's almost a romantic concept. And to get the attention of people in America, I'm getting a little bit down on America these days at times, which I don't, that's not really a good thing, but like our myopia, because we are a global, the more I interview people that have the global view, it's like Americans are blithely on their way going through the fast food line and not connecting fast enough for me. But then I temper that with guests like you who say that let's have hope, things are changing, it's all good. And there's the Savory Institute out there doing the good work. But a little bit more about the I'm getting the 2-minute mark, so let's not start this. But you have, I love the concept of the savory hubs.
Those are critical.
They're critical, and I think when we come back, you should talk a little bit about that, and then cover the areas that you want to, because I want to get to the positive pieces, of which there are many in what you're doing, and how do we continue, to spread the word, and I really do want to talk to you a little bit about the concept of raising beef. Because a lot of my guests, as I spoke to you earlier today, how sustainable is it? And under the holistic management plan, is it one solution to feed a burgeoning population? I mean, how are we going to feed? We're having trouble feeding the 7 billion. How are we going to get to feeding the 10 billion? And is holistic management of grasslands and the cattle on it clearly a solution? Because what I'm just going to go here to the break is what you are talking about, in my mind, is an integrated approach. And I interview guests week after week after week, and their focus is solar, or their focus is reducing CO2 emissions, or reforestation. I mean, there are many. And I see some hope around the country of what I call an integration of thought, because if we don't integrate all the pieces and realize it's one planet, we are on a path to disaster, I think, more quickly. So anyway, we're going to come back on an up note. Everybody, stay here with me, interviewing Alan Savory. He's the president of the Savory Institute, and we are going to talk about some of the Savory hubs.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine, it's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines, it gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
We rely on your generosity for our inventory. Homeowners, renters, contractors, and business owners keep the Habit Store stocked with building supplies, furniture, and appliances. You can drop off your donations or give us a call at 889-7200 to schedule a free pickup of items that are in good condition. Your donations means Habitat Tucson can build and renovate more homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturday, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if you have just joined us, you have missed a really great show. I encourage you to go back and listen to the podcast when it's up so that you can soak in every word of this. Our guest today is Alan Savory, and he's the president of the Savory Institute. The Savory Institute was created to promote large-scale restoration of the world's grasslands through holistic management. And I'd love to talk about the Savory Hubs, Alan, because this is, to me, one way that you can affect large-scale change, which I believe we drastically need, desperately need.
All right. Let me take this. If we're going to succeed worldwide, we have to get people moving and institutions. So we have a strategy of focusing on the grasslands of the world first, where we can get the highest return in terms of addressing all the problems I mentioned earlier, and where it's most urgent, but also trying to facilitate change in our institutions. Because if you study history, organizations and institutions cannot change, even if they want to accepting new scientific insights ahead of public opinion. So we're trying to do everything we can to get the public more aware so that we can facilitate the change in our institutions. So we have a two-pronged strategy. Now, one prong that's hitting both parts of this is forming affiliated hubs around the world. These are saying, let's not wait any longer for leadership to come from politicians or
public
any
policy,
organization.
Right.
Yeah, it cannot. It cannot. Let's accept that this has been established by system science and the research. I don't have time to go into it now. It cannot. So let's get ordinary people moving where they can see hope, common sense, etc., and let's try to get common sense and science moving. So we're encouraging locally led and managed hubs around the world where people are coming together in their personal capacities, whatever organization they're in, farmers, ranchers, etc., beginning to manage holistically, learn together, train, etc., and then we're affiliating these globally through a sophisticated internet platform at the Institute to speed it up. Now, that's happening. Last year, we had our conference in Berlin, had, I think it was 10 nations involved. These are forming all over the world. So this year, there's so much interest that the conference on 1st and 2nd of August is moved to London to make it easier for the European countries.
I think I have to be there.
Oh, please. Yeah, you'll meet so many good people.
Oh, my God. What a dream that would be for me. Okay, so go ahead. I don't mean to interrupt the flow. This is really important. It's like, so
any help that people can give to support our hub strategy and support these hubs around the world would always be a wonderful investment in the future of your grandchildren or whatever. So that's a major part of our strategy today. I'm excited about it after many years of trying to train individual instructors, have them train other farmers, and I could sum it up with the Australian experience. I was with our, what we call educators that had trained with me some time ago, and I said, you guys have done a wonderful job. How many farmers have you trained around Australia? And they said, 1,000. And I said, great job. That took you 20 years.
Oh my gosh.
We're running out of time. You've got 139,000 other Australian farmers to train. We've got to change tactics. And that's why we're bringing in the hub strategy, so that we can have local people, local culture, local language, training millions of farmers in the, at the timescale we need to begin to seriously address climate change desertification. Any support that people can give that would be wonderful.
And I think people, you know, we'll send this out on our social media channels, but if you go to thesavoryinstitute.com, there's so much content there to read. Did you say .org?
.org.
Okay. There I go, and I just thought I put in .com. But anyway, there's a donation page, and I always encourage people, you can donate as little or as much as you can, and all of it matters. I mean, to me, everything that we do, people sometimes think, well, I don't have, you know, $1,000 to donate. It doesn't matter. It matters that everybody tried to help a little bit, and it ends up helping a lot. Who are some of the, do you have some big, I don't know what to call them, but big dogs, some big, what I would call environmental entrepreneurs, are they looking and watching and working with you and helping to move this forward?
You know, some are beginning to. Some wonderful people who are concerned with really, truly triple bottom line investment, etc., are working with us through a grasslands division we have, where we're buying ranches in the United States, Hawaii, New Zealand, etc., and managing them for them. These are very, very good people beginning to get a truly triple bottom line, in other words, helping society,
right,
locally, etc. And then the large organizations are beginning to work with us, which is wonderful. The Nature Conservancy is now working with us in Patagonia, in Colorado, and in China. So change is coming about. We just need to accelerate it by getting public support for the very concept of managing holistically. So it's really very encouraging at the moment, but time is not on our side.
Time is not on our side. And the collaborations, I see them coming, even when we, I did some shows after we had the Wallow fire, which was a big fire. It was almost 600,000 acres. It was you know, deemed a mega fire. And organizations that had offices down the street from each other had not historically worked together, including the Forest Service and the Nature Conservancy and Game and Fish. And believe me, and the tribes, there's much more of a collaborative approach now because of the you know, just the realization that the fire doesn't really care who owns the land, it's coming. So we better help figure out how to heal it, because the investment in our future is all really worthwhile. And I just
do. Can I use that as an example? I looked at a very good documentary on the mega fires And it's wonderful. And you're right. We have to collaborate, and we have to have an integrated approach. But what I'm talking about goes beyond that, because in that entire wonderful documentary on fire, the only solution being suggested was more fire. And remember I said earlier, humans only have technology, fire, as tools. We have got to bring livestock into that equation and manage holistically, then we can begin to address the megafires. If we don't do that, I'll stake my life on it, the megafires will increase.
And they are. I mean, they already are. I don't know what's going to happen with California. I just think it might burn up this summer. When I was at the Food Institute at Monterey Bay a couple of weeks ago, Southern California was burning up, and it's May. I mean, it was like late April. And we're just a tinderbox here in the Southwest with very little rain, and it terrifies me because I saw what the devastation can be. So talk about some of the very – go ahead. Do you want to comment on that?
Gina, could I move to the beef question you raised earlier?
Yes, very definitely.
Yes. As I pointed out, and I would wish that any scientist in the world would tell me where I'm wrong, we have no option but to use large herbivores. This is cattle, sheep, goats, camels, whatever, and the wildlife. Now, when we try to move with that, you'll see what's happening in the public is there are three what I call distractions. People are now beginning to argue that if we reverse the desertification in the grasslands of the world, which is most of the world's land, how much carbon will it absorb? How can we measure it? That's an academic point. Let me raise another. People are saying, oh, but these cattle, if we increase their numbers and get them out of the feedlots and back onto the land where they're desperately needed, it will produce amazing amounts of methane. Okay, that's another distraction. Another one is, should we eat red meat at all? No, we need to eat white meat and so on. These I call distractions because let me explain it this way. If I assume for a moment, and this is 100% wrong, let me assume that the grasslands of the world, as we reverse the desertification, could absorb absolutely no carbon. Let me assume that cattle back on the land put out 10 times the methane that they do. We know that's wrong, but assume it. And let's assume that every human became a vegan and no humans ate meat from here on. You still would have absolutely no option available to scientists, climatologists, all of us, except to use large herbivores, mostly livestock, to address desertification and climate change. So these delaying issues that people discuss and argue over, if they delay us another year or two or 5 years for action, all that will mean is trillions of dollars more for insurance companies, military having to deal with violence, etc., immigration to Europe, etc., and billions of lives lost in the long run. So we need to get moving, or somebody needs to show where this is wrong.
And I will tell you this. I've been doing this for 6 years, and nobody... no guest I've had, and I think I've had stellar guests, has brought this up with the whole global integrated perspective that you have. I have no answer, and I told you I was going to ask you that question. Look at the problems that cows are causing with methane is what is fed to us, and it's not the whole story. And when you lead us through why that doesn't really work, even as a, you know, a thought, it shifted me. I mean, your thinking influenced me, and you're right. It's a scientific combination of factors that, you know, I wish I had 10 million listeners to this show to help clarify it for the public, because we're getting filtered information with people that usually have an axe to grind or a cause to support. And I love that you call them distractions. They've worked on me. I mean, I'm saying it on the air. It's very, the whole concept of what you're talking about is unsettling to me, because up until now, I have not heard it put together that way. And I think it's really, really, really important.
And I get that, thank you, but I get that reaction from a lot of people. I wish your program was going out to millions fortunately, the internet is enabling us to do this more and more. Your podcast can go out. And I recently did a documentary on the land where I live half the year in Zimbabwe. I did a documentary with some Arab filmers, and they told me that will go up to 120 million people in the Arab world over Ramadan. So I'm excited about that, because that whole area right across North Africa through the former Soviet republics up to China, including China, is suffering terribly from desertification. And in that vast area, two or three times the size of the United States, only 5% or less of that land can feed people from crops. The rest can only feed people from livestock. And almost all organizations and governments are pushing the decrease of livestock and the destruction of pastoral cultures in this ancient belief that assumed scientific validity that livestock were cause of desertification. That's what I covered in the TED Talk.
And it upsets me. Like, it angers me as a citizen. I don't like to feel like I've been duped. And it's, you know, it's probably one of my things that I say in the show, if it's not about the money, it's about the money. So at the bottom of some of this is big money telling us what to think. But I digress. So ways that people can help and calls to action. And I did look, because I have my computer up. Someone who set your website up is brilliant, because you can get to the Savory Institute by using .com or .org, and it's people know that. So it's, you know, that's good to know. There is a donate button. That is one way, that is a significant way for people to help in whatever way they can. And then the other piece to me is really inspiring people to educate themselves. That's what you did for me. I live this. I am Mrs. Green. I might as well change my name. So I am a voracious reader, constantly researching about these issues. But I just hope that people take the time to spend time on your website, to look at the TED Talk, and to realize that we have all the power. People have the power. And if we wait for the policymakers, we'll all be dead. We'll all be toast.
You're absolutely right. Only the people have the power. Policy makers, which means institutions, cannot change until the public is insisting that policies and management be holistic. They cannot change even if they want to.
And
that's why I never blame the organizations or politicians.
Right, right.
I've been that route. I was a leader of a political party, president of a political party, and I was defeated more than anybody in my nation during a long civil war. So, you know, I've gone there and believed I could produce change. I couldn't. And only after our long war, many, many people said to me, oh, if only we'd listened. But they couldn't listen because I was pushing a new direction where the bulk of the population thought the old way.
Yeah, way before its time. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. But talk about a wake-up call. And the life we're saving is our own. I mean, that's what I say to people. It's not about, you know, saving the grasslands. It's about saving our lives. And you talk about, I have grandchildren. And there are days when I wonder if it is too late. And then I get guests like you that are putting up savory hubs all over the globe. And it gives me hope. And it's daunting sometimes to interview the guests that I do to, you know, understand the complexity of the challenges. But thanks for giving us hope.
Well, don't forget that Margaret Mead said it well, that the only change in the world comes from few people.
Yes.
That's the only thing that does produce change. And
never doubt it.
Yeah, no one of your listeners is too small or too insignificant. They all matter.
And that helps for me. Like when we get, you know, 1,000 listeners or 6,000 listeners, I say to myself, why isn't it 10,000? Why isn't it 20? Well, if it's two or three that change their lives as a result of a show, it's starting the ripple effect. And it's, to me, it's really important. So, Alan, I am absolutely the emotional guest host. I'm not training to be flatlined like some of the other stations. I hope that you felt my passion and my respect and my absolute awe of the work that you're doing and my gratitude. Thank you for what you're doing for the planet. Everybody, next week we have another great guest, Lori David. She was the producer of An Inconvenient Truth. She helped produce the movie Fed Up. And when you hear her, you are going to be fed up about all the sugar in our food. Alan, thank you very much. Keep up the good work. And if I get lucky, I might knock on your door in London. Everybody, make it a great green day. Thank you. And check out savoryinstitute.org. You'll be glad you did.